The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're exploring the human evolutionary tree and all its various branches. And later, we'll discuss whether or not people have had enough influence on the planet to warrant the naming of a new epoch. Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. I'm here with Chip Walter, the founder of the popular website allthingshuman.net, a former CNN bureau chief, screenwriter, and documentary filmmaker. His articles have appeared in the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, The Economist, Discover, Scientific American, Slate, and numerous other fine publications and websites. He is the author of 4 books, and he's here today to discuss his most recent one, Last Ape Standing, the 7-million-year story of how and why we survived. Chip, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
You open your book with this quote, which I quite liked. A good deal of brawling often goes on within the field of paleoanthropology. What did you mean by that?
I mean, it has a history. Well, paleoanthropology, which of course deals with our past and the creatures that we evolved from. You know, there's a lot of room for speculation. I mean, you're dealing with fossil records, you're dealing with, you know, a lot of information that is difficult to scientifically nail down. So there's a lot of debate, frankly, you know, and probably the biggest debates are, is this fossil from this species or that species? And one of the things I wanted to point out in the book is these are all kind of artificial things that we create so that we can try to understand what all of these bones, you know, mean and what the genetics of the creatures that we evolve from, you know, can tell us. So let's just put it this way. It's not scientific in the way that, say, pure mathematics is, or even physics, some parts of physics. It's more like metaphysics.
How many human species have existed on Earth, I guess, that we know about so far?
Yeah, the ones we know about so far are now number, depending on who you talk to, 27 species. That's 27 species of humans. We're not talking about chimpanzees or, you know, other kinds of primates. And that's defined essentially as upright walking, you know, savanna apes would be another term that you could use, that, you know, scientists consider to be human species that have been found and lived between now and the past 7 million years.
So we often think of the human species and the human evolutionary process as sort of stretching out behind us in a long kind of single file line. But the truth is, as it so often is, much more complicated. And a lot of these human species actually existed at the same time, possibly competed with each other?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of evidence for that already. And again, I think that we're going to find, I mean, if we found 27 so far, I'll just take a wild guess and say that we're going to find at least 100 other human species that existed, not all at the same time, but over the last 7 million years, meaning that many of them coexisted. And just as recently as 75,000 years ago, we know of right now, somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 5, you know, human species, because there's some debate, that were coexisting at the same time. 75,000 years ago in evolutionary terms is nothing. Even as recently as 25,000 years ago, there were 3 or 4. I think that there were probably at least 100. But it's pretty amazing that there were 27. And when I came across that information, that's really what got me going on writing the book, because then I said, well, where did they go? And why is it that we're the only one left?
Yeah. So I'm curious, how do you trace back to actually find sort of our line of evolution if there's all these extra branches and some of the human species have sort of turned out to be evolutionary sort of dead ends?
Again, I think it's not as simple as we, you know, many scientists would like for it to be, or even we would like for it to be. But there are some clear dead ends, simply because what you see in the fossil record are, you know, particular kinds of primates that look a particular kind of way. You know, they're very distinctive. There was a whole line of, you know, multiple lines of a particular kind of upright walking savanna ape that are called, you know, the robustus line. And they were essentially fascinating and very successful species that weren't meat eaters. So, you know, they had these big jaws and they had rather large heads and they had this crest, a sagittal crest, you know, across the top. It was almost like a helmet. And so they had a very distinctive look. And so it's easy to see that they just kind of stopped. You know, they kind of disappear probably around 3 million years ago. So, but they had about a million year run. So they were doing pretty well.
A million years is a long time. I mean, like...
A lot of time.
Our species hasn't been around for a million years.
No way. I mean, we've been maybe at 200,000 years if we're lucky.
So let's go back to the beginning, as it were. When did the first human species appear?
Well, again, it's always tricky, but... And there's debate, but general consensus seems to be that right around 7 million years ago, you begin to see the first evidence of, in Chad, country of Chad in Africa, you see the very first evidence of what appears to be an upright walking primate. Probably walked upright and also walked in trees. You know, you don't have very much fossil record left, so you're trying to extrapolate a lot from a few bones. But it's around that time, and some people will say that some scientists believe that this was actually the last, this may have been a precursor to the first humans. You know, this might have been related to both the chimpanzee line and our line, you know, before we actually split off. But we'll let them debate that, but that's around the time when you begin to see the first, you know, savanna primates.
We've already talked about upright walking, and that is really one of the big things that differentiated this kind of first properly human ancestor from other primates of that same era.
That's key. It's a key thing, and for a whole lot of different reasons. It set in motion so many, you know, events that essentially led to us coming into being. By 3.5 million years ago, with Lucy, you know, the famous fossil, you see that the line of savanna apes, almost all savanna apes are walking upright full time, and that changed, you know, not only the way they move, but it increased their chances of survival. That's probably why they were selected, you know, to walk upright, because when you're in a jungle, walking upright is not particularly helpful. When you're in the savannah, it's very helpful. But in walking upright, our pelvis, the birth canal also became smaller, and that created huge problems. At the same time, it was helping us survive.
I'm going to get to the birth canal issues in just a second, but what were some of the benefits for living in the savannah when it comes to walking upright?
We were kind of forced by climate change. Before 7 million years ago, or around 6 million years ago, you've got all kinds of apes, you know, primates all over the planet, everywhere, most of them in jungles. And then because of climate change, you start to get this savannah very slowly. You begin to get this savannah environment. And that means it's much more open. There's not food, literally low-hanging fruit all over the place. You have predators out there that are also evolving. So you have big cats that are out there that are nasty hunters, hyenas, that sort of thing. And so you've got to be able to get around, and you've got to be able to get around efficiently, and you've got to be able to see better. And standing upright helps you to do all those things. But if you're bent over walking on all fours, knuckle walking like most jungle primates do, you use up twice as much energy, actually. So walking upright, you use half that energy. And that's important because it's going to take you a lot longer to find food. It's just not around. And find water, and also to be keeping an eye out for the other predators that are around that might want to have you for lunch instead of the other way around.
Does walking upright give us any kind of speed advantage over knuckle walking?
Yeah, animals can move pretty fast on all fours, but it does give you an advantage. And we became very good, took a while, but we became not only good walkers, but very good runners. What we're really good at is we're fairly fast, but what we're really good at is long distance running. I mean, there are still tribes of people that can run animals literally to death. So humans developed, our line of humans, you know, developed really kind of incredible ability to just run long, long distances.
And I suppose when you're roaming around looking for scarce food, that's probably a pretty good advantage.
Yeah. I mean, you literally can just keep running the animal down until it gets so tired that then you can kill it.
You're listening to Science for the People. I'm here with Chip Walter, author of the book Last Ape Standing, the 7 million year story of how and why we survived. I was surprised how important the evolution of the big toe was in all of this. I never really, you know, sort of gave it much credit.
I actually came across that, and that was a big part of the previous book I wrote called Thumbs, Toes, and Tears, and Other Traits That Make Us Human. Because I was looking for, well, what are, you know, if you could try to figure out what are the really most basic traits that humans have that you could trace almost all of our behaviors back to, big toe turned out to be enormously important because you can't really stand upright without a big toe. And all you got to do is stub it, which happens from time to time, to realize how important it is. First of all, it's incredibly painful when you stub your toe, which is one way of nature telling you that something's important. The other thing is that it enables us to, you know, support an enormous amount of weight, shift the weight on our feet, be able to run, cut, jump. You know, when you see a football player or a basketball player or any kind of athlete, you know, or a ballet dancer, you know, moving the way they do, they simply would not be able to move the way they do without a big toe. And we take it for granted, but it's absolutely necessary. If you lost it, you wouldn't be able to do any of those things.
Now, it wasn't just walking upright that started to set us apart from our closest relatives. Our brains were also undergoing some key changes.
Yeah, they were growing larger, and probably, I mean, again, you could debate this, and there are probably lots of reasons why things happened, but they were growing larger among savanna primates. For the first couple million years, they weren't growing larger real fast, but they were getting bigger. And that probably means they were getting more complicated, more complex. And that probably means that there was a selection process taking place that selected for more intelligence. Because when you're out there and it's really rough out there on the savannah, you know, if you're smarter, chances are you have a better chance of surviving. Problem was that our brains were getting larger, pelvis was getting smaller because we were standing upright, and that narrowed the birth canal. And so really get to a point in evolution around 2 million years ago where you've got a real problem because you can't get a larger brain out, you know, in birth, you know, without somebody dying, mom or baby dying. And so there had to be some kind of a solution that evolution came up with. And, or, you know, we wouldn't be sitting here talking.
I was wincing all throughout that. You couldn't see me. So what was the solution?
I was really a smart solution. I guess, you know, evolution has a way of figuring things out, or I suppose you'd just die off. But essentially, we're born earlier. When you get to the point where you simply can't, again, at the risk of wincing, you know, squeeze a head out of the birth canal, then you have to basically bring that child into the world sooner. And we come in way sooner. I mean, we're now an extreme version of this solution, you know, but we're born 10 months earlier than a gorilla would be born, for example. If we were as physically mature as a gorilla, we would be in the womb for 20 months. And that would not be acceptable to your mother. It would be very, and you wouldn't be able to get out. You know, your brain would be too big. Your head would be too big. So we had to be born earlier. And that is why our brain triples in size after birth. And that's enormously important because what that means is that your brain is being shaped by your environment and your personal experience while it's growing rapidly. And that's why you and I, though we are members of the same species, have completely different views, you know, proclivities, talents. You know, we see the world differently because during those critical first 3 years, we were in different circumstances and our brain was shaped by different experience.
We've solved the problem evolutionarily of big heads and walking upright. We've got that sorted out. But now we have a new problem, which is human babies are now born really helpless, which is probably its own evolutionary problem, really.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's kind of amazing, really, when you think about it, that we're around at all. Because when you get to the point where you have these incredibly helpless babies being born, and now you have parents, you know, that are on the savannah, life's already pretty hard. And now you have this helpless baby to take care of. So that changed the social dynamics of the relationships between other members of the troop. If you look at chimpanzees, I mean, there's a lot of help that goes on within the troop, but babies are born, you know, kind of drop out. You know, they even help themselves get born. And whenever they come out, they're pretty much ready to go. They climb back up on the top of their mother's back. And they're, you know, walking pretty soon, within days, and they get around and they begin to take care of themselves, you know, much sooner than we do. And by the way, their brain pretty much wired up by the first year of life. Whereas we're talking in the case of our species of, you know, babies can't even hold their heads up and they can't see. They need constant care. So you can imagine that this would change the social dynamics within the troop because you've got to have mates that are useful and helpful. You've got to have grandmothers and grandfathers fathers, others in the troop. So you wanted to do everything you could to increase chances of the troop continuing.
Now, you mentioned already one group of sort of human evolution that was going on, which I believe was the robust humans. But there was also kind of a parallel set of species that were evolving as well, which were the gracile humans.
That's the group that we're descendants of. And those were the ones that essentially began to have to deal with this problem of earlier birth because they, at some point, for some reason, decided that they would eat less nuts and berries and fruits and tubers and that sort of thing, which is what the robustus group was eating and which why they needed these, you know, large teeth and their big heads and everything. And we were eating more protein. We were eating probably essentially roadkill. You know, we were carrion, whatever was left out there because we hadn't developed at that point into great hunters like we would later. And so, but we were getting more protein. And what that was doing was that was accelerating the growth of the brain. And so that exacerbated that problem of early birth and upright walking. But it also was essentially a way of evolution saying, you know what, we're going to opt, instead of bigger stomachs and being able to eat all this other kind of food, we're going to opt for bigger brains, even though it's a more dangerous approach. It just turned out that it worked. It's really kind of unusual in evolution for that sort of thing to happen because it lengthened our childhood and it lengthened the time before we would bring new children into the troop.
It also made child rearing so much more intensive.
Yeah, I, again, because you have, I mean, all you have to do is, you know, look at a mother or father grappling with a 2 or 3 year old in the grocery store. I mean, you know, you've got big cats roaming around. It's very dangerous. Not only you're dealing with disease and climate and, you know, just getting food every day, you have to feed this new baby. You have to protect it. You have to watch it all the time. You have to make sure it's not making a lot of noise so that, you know, it doesn't attract attention from predators. So yeah, it makes it much more difficult. And as a result, I think it bound one of the reasons we were already evolving, you know, the descendants of highly social animals like chimpanzees and gorillas. But when you're out on the savannah and there's only a small group of you and probably troops were 25, you know, or 30 individuals, you're in a lot of trouble. You really need one another. And I think that's why we're so social. And I think that's why one of the paradoxes of human behavior is that we both need and must cooperate with one another, but we also compete with one another. And so we're constantly trying to juggle those two balls every day in every relationship. And it makes, you know, human behavior, I think it kind of explains almost all human behavior.
So you mentioned before that our brains go through sort of this postnatal hyper-accelerated growth. And that takes both a lot of energy to do. And also, you know, obviously our brains get bigger, but it also has a lot to do with the way those pathways are connecting.
Right after birth, well, before birth, the human brain and almost any primate brain, but in our case, is making connections at a furious rate. I mean, I had a statistic in the book that I can't remember right now, but hundreds of thousands of connections getting made and neurons being created every hour. And so this kind of accelerated growth, brain growth, goes on in our case after birth. It continues because we're essentially fetal apes. It's like we're born too early. So everything that's happening in the womb just continues to happen once we're in the world. And that goes back to what I was saying before. This is happening at the same time that you are, as a, you know, experiencing the world as an individual. This is critical to the reason why we are the way we are. It's why different people have different ideas, different views, different creative insight. And, you know, all this begins right after birth and during those early years. And we have this elongated childhood, which to me is essentially why we survived. It explains why we're the last ape standing. And during that childhood, we are shaped by our environment and we carry those, you know, experiences and the brain that is shaped by those experiences into our life. And that's what makes us all different.
In your book, you gave, for me, what was a really startling example of this kind of thing, which was the story about anthropologist Colin Turnbull encountering Baumubti, I'm sure I pronounced that wrong, tribesmen looking at a herd of buffalo.
Right, yeah. I came across, it's just a great story. I came across that years ago, and then I remembered it whenever I was researching this particular part of the book. And it's a great example of how your environment shapes the way your brain works. With the story is that the scientist was working with pygmies in Congo, you know, become very close to a lot of the people in the tribe. And he made a trip later with one of the members of the tribe, and they were standing. One of the things you have to remember about Pygmy tribesmen is that they grow up in dense forest. So they really don't ever see very far because there isn't, you know, anything that's far away in the distance. Everything's close. So, you know, when he went with, he was standing on a precipice above a savanna with this tribesman, and they were looking out at a herd of, I think it was wildebeests. You know, the tribesman thought that they were bugs that were out there because he thought that because they were small, they were, you know, right on the ground there and simply looked like bugs. And you know, they kind of astounded the scientist because he said, well, no, they're far away and they're actually rather large, but because they're far away, they look small. And it was just a graphic way of showing that this tribesman's brain literally could not see distance. You know, it just hadn't ever had to. And so the connections in the brain that are necessary to see that never formed and actually get pared away later. This is, you know, in the first couple of years of our life, we make these connections and in our brains for to almost everything. But later, what's not being used gets pared away. And in the case of this tribesman, since he never had to see in distance, visual cortex just, you know, pared those connections away. And he was now forever incapable of seeing things far away and realizing that they were far away.
This is incredibly fascinating to me. We had a guest on a few weeks back who was talking about that that visual illusion with the lines, where one line has arrows sort of pointing out and the other has sort of arrow ends, where the triangles are the opposite direction and one looks longer than the other, but in actuality they're the same length. And they did some research and some studies and found that they really only sort of people who have grown up in westernized culture or in sort of big cities where there's lots of straight sidewalks and lots of parallel lines and sort of vanishing points and perspective. Do people actually see these lines as being different? But if you haven't grown up in that kind of culture, if you've grown up in a sort of natural environment without these kinds of straight roads and, you know, big, straight, tall buildings, you see these lines as being the same width. The illusion isn't there, which I feel is very similar to this. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And it really makes you think or realize that almost everything is essentially an illusion. The brain evolved simply, any brain, you know, evolved simply to kind of filter all the information that's coming to you. And we just happen to have the most complex brains of any creature on the planet, as far as we know. But we're creating really elaborate illusions. Now, the illusions have to work well enough that you survive. You know, they have to be accurate enough. But, we operate under the illusion that everything we see is actually the way it is. Everything we experience is actually the way it is. Well, it isn't necessarily. It's simply the way our brain presents it to us, and it presents it accurately enough that we've managed to survive. But, you know, there's all kinds of visual illusions, auditory illusions that we just accept as reality.
You're listening to Science for the People. We'll be right back after the break to talk more with Chip Walter, so don't go away.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. I'm here today with Chip Walter, science journalist, author, and founder of the website allthingshuman.net. He's here with us today to talk about his latest book, Last Ape Standing, the 7-million-year story of how and why we survived. Some paleoanthropologists think that the human species at one point may have come really, really close to going extinct. Why do they suspect there was this sort of bottleneck event?
Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about is us. I mean, this was 75,000 years ago. And at this point, our species has been fully evolved. We are the way we are today. We're just different technology, way further back in time, but essentially the very same people. And so we're talking about Homo sapiens being on the brink of extinction. There's evidence in the genetic record. When I say genetic record, if you kind of, it's complicated, it's explained in the book, but you know, you can kind of look at genetic markers and you can see when a species was in trouble, you know, and then when it began to expand, assuming that it survived, just as you can see when it ended, you know, from a genetic record. And so what you see in our species is around 75,000 years ago, we got down to very small numbers. There was, you know, very little diversity in the genetic code. One scientist, Curtis Marion, actually believes that there was a place that I was actually at recently for another article that I'm writing for National Geographic magazine on the origin of the modern mind, where there were these caves at the very tip of South Africa, and he believes that that was it. There were a few hundred Homo sapiens left down there. Most scientists would say that there were a few thousand, you know, maybe 10,000 of us left scattered around Africa in pockets, but, you know, all just barely hanging on.
So do we have any theories about why this happened or what caused us to dwindle?
Well, there's two things. One is that there was a huge ice age going on at that time and pretty much had frozen most of Europe and northern Asia. And so ice sheets were way down, you know, south, much further than they, even in previous ice ages, than they normally were. And what this tended to do in Africa and South Asia is just dry things out. And when you dry things out, then you begin to, you know, disrupt the food chain. And so animals of all kinds were going extinct. And since humans were, you know, even then, pretty much at the top of the food chain, you know, they just weren't getting very much food. So if you were living in the savanna in Africa, you probably died out from lack of water and lack of food. But a few pockets managed to survive for various reasons, probably. And we know that in South Africa, you know, pocket managed to survive because they were living near the coast and there was still game and a lot of seafood. And they had learned how to, you know, fish and live off that seafood. So they managed to survive. And after this ice age went by, you know, passed, you know, then you got more moisture and things improved. The other thing was that there was a huge volcanic explosion over in Toba in Indonesia. That's, as far as any scientist knows, the largest volcanic explosion in the history of the planet, you know, where there were miles and miles and miles of, you know, cubic miles of dirt thrown into the atmosphere. And that would have created a kind of winter because it cooled the atmosphere, darkened the atmosphere, blotted out the sun. And that wouldn't have helped matters when you're in the middle of an ice age. So it may have made things even worse. And we really took it on the chin. There were still Neanderthals around and they were managing to survive up in Europe and Denisovans up in Asia. And probably Homo erectus, you know, but they all managed to survive because they weren't in the path.
So it's interesting to think that we may have come so close to dying out, and yet now we're literally everywhere, living in pretty much every kind and type of environment, including some pretty harsh ones. And I know this firsthand because winter is coming here in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada.
Yes, I think that that is one of them. I mean, it's a telling thing about our species. There isn't any other species except for bacteria or something like that, but, you know, certainly no other mammals or even birds or this sort of thing, you know, that live in every environment. We live in every environment. And essentially, it's because of what happened earlier in our evolution. You know, this whole issue of larger brains and then brains that are shaped in childhood that make us much more creative. And that led to us being very inventive and adaptive creatures so that we got to the point where we weren't simply, you know, managing to survive what nature was throwing at us, you know, because we were smart, but we actually began to change the environment around us so that it was more hospitable. So even though winter is coming in Alberta, you know, you will have a nice warm place to go to. You'll have heat, you'll have windows, you'll have, you know, a roof over your head and a car to, you know, drive around in. And that's all because of these things that changed our brain, you know, earlier in our evolution and made us so creative.
Okay, so let's talk Neanderthals. Now, is it Neanderthals or Neanderthals?
It kind of depends on whether you're, you know, from Europe or the United States. So
both are valid.
Yes, both are valid. You can go either way.
What do we know about Neanderthals? What did they look like and what do the fossils reveal about how they may have lived?
Well, they actually, in many ways, look like us. There was an experiment done where someone put an actor in a Neanderthal, you know, made them up to look like a Neanderthal and then dressed them in regular street clothes and put them out in the streets of New York and no one even blinked an eye. But if you, you know, strip all of that off and you don't put a suit on them, there are a couple of interesting things. They were bigger than us. I mean, not taller than us, but they were, you know, much stronger than us. You can tell this from the bones that are found. You know, not only are they thicker, but you can see that the ligaments that connected to them, you know, had to be bigger and stronger. longer. They were just an incredibly tough species. You have to remember that we split off from them from a common ancestor about 400,000 years ago in Africa. They migrated, their ancestors migrated up to Europe, and it was cold up there. And so over the next 200,000 years or 400,000 years, they were in a cold climate and they adapted to that climate, or those that survived were selected to adapt to that climate. And our direct line was still living down in Africa. And so they had like larger noses, fleshier noses, probably warmed the air more. They had very big shoulders. They seemed to be able to withstand cold better. And they developed lighter skin and probably red hair and blonde hair and that sort of thing, which was a reaction to less sunlight. So they needed more vitamin D. And so they reduced the amount of melatonin in their skin. So if you, we know now that we mated with Neanderthals in the past. So if you have freckles or red hair, then chances are you've got some Neanderthal in you.
Nice. I have freckles.
Yeah, there you go.
Excellent. See? Mm-hmm. What do we know about the way they lived or how their culture came about?
Well, we know, and I'm actually working a lot on this article I'm writing for National Geographic. We know that they were symbolic. We know that they cared about one another because they buried their dead. There are fossils of some quite old. If you got into your 50s in those days, you were ancient. And so there's evidence of some Neanderthal who were injured or old, and yet they didn't die until they got well into old age. So that means that they were taken care of. I mean, some of these people probably couldn't walk or keep up with the troop, but the troop took care of them and kept them alive. There's evidence of symbolic use of ochre now and feathers and that sort of thing. There isn't a lot of evidence that they were cave painters, although there may have been some symbols that they used. But we don't know what their language was like. There's, you know, seems to be some evidence that their language wasn't as, maybe quite as verbal in the sense that ours is, the syntax, that sort of thing. There might have been kind of one scientist, Stephen Mithen, believes that it was more sing-songy and that they may have communicated, you know, in very, very sophisticated ways, you know, using gesture and kind of the prosody in our voices, you know, the up and down melody in our voices, as opposed to lots of words. You know, this is speculation, but it's pretty informed speculation. It's just interesting. I mean, we were separated from them for 400,000 years. So they obviously went another way, but they were equally as intelligent, which makes them incredibly fascinating.
In addition to the harsh environments and climates they were in, there's also evidence that the life of a Neanderthal was not, a walk in the park. There's a lot of injuries and sort of damage to the fossils.
Yeah, one of the descriptions that one scientist used said that the fossil, the bones that they left behind, they look like bronco busters, you know, because it's so many broken bones, and this probably indicates that in hunting, they were often injured, and there's evidence that they used spears. They used these really long 15-foot pikes, you know, that to hunt with. But there isn't any evidence that they developed the ability to throw spears or to use spear throwers, which Homo sapiens did develop. And what that meant is that they had to get within 15 feet of some pretty big animals if they were going to try to kill them. I mean, even a large deer, you know, can hurt you, let alone a mammoth or something along those lines, or rhinoceros or something. So there's some speculation that they may have, one way that they hunted was to actually jump on the back of, say, a rhinoceros and then take the pike and put it down between the shoulders to make an instant kill. That's a pretty dangerous way to hunt. Anytime you get that close to any kind of a wild animal, you're liable to get hurt. There's a lot of evidence that they did. And it was cold, you know. They lived in a rough environment. They were a hardy, tough, smart people.
You mentioned that there's some Neanderthal DNA still living in those of us today with things like freckles and red hair. Mm-hmm. And that we know for sure that Neanderthals mated with our ancestors who were living at the time. How do we know that? Is there some physical evidence?
There's not really physical evidence. There's genetic evidence. 20 years ago, we were still struggling with mapping our own genome, but since then, our genome has been completely mapped, and from the fossil record, we got good enough genetics or DNA to be able to entirely map the Neanderthal genome. I actually talked to the scientist that did this recently. And what you do is once you have them both mapped, then you compare them and you can see that we have some identical genes in both species. And that's the proof that we made it. And so somewhere around, if you're not directly from Africa, if you know your ancestors came through Europe or Asia, then you probably have somewhere between 2 and 4% of your DNA that's Neanderthal. We were getting together with them.
I believe there were also a couple of fossils found that showed a little sort of mix of both Neanderthal physicality, I guess is the word.
Yeah. You do. You see in a couple of places in Eastern Europe and also in Portugal, you see some fossils that seem to indicate that those people had both, you know, Neanderthal traits, physical traits, like they had this occipital, what's called an occipital bun, kind of, you know, bun on the back of their head, you know, that was very distinctive trait. And the shape of their head was slightly different, more oblong than ours. Ours is more egg-shaped. Those fossils seem to indicate that those people were part Neanderthal, and they had some Neanderthal traits and some human traits, or I shouldn't say human traits because they were human, Homo sapien traits.
So we've established that Neanderthals were smart, that they were pretty strong and able to live in pretty harsh climates, and yet they did not survive. Do we know why they didn't make it?
Well, there's lots of theories, some brawling going on. the three main theories are that we just murdered them outright, that Homo sapiens came, you know, around 45,000 years, began to move out of Africa and into Europe, and whenever we met up with them. You know, this argument states that Homo sapiens had superior technology, they were better communicators, and essentially it's like Columbus and Pizarro and people like that showing up in North America and just obliterating Native American tribes or the Incas or something. It doesn't necessarily have to be that simple. It's also possible that we just kind of outcompeted them, that we, you know, we were, again, had, we did seem to have some superior technology, so that whenever we moved in, first of all, because we were growing faster, you know, multiplying faster, we're just kind of taking over territories, the kind of the best hunting ground, so to speak, forcing Neanderthals into areas that where they were already having a hard time surviving. They never reached more than 100,000 all spread all across Europe. So they were very small enclaves. And so this only made matters worse for them. The other possibility is that we loved them to death. You know, that we met up with them. They were human. They were smart. They were different. But, you know, we mated with them. And the genetic evidence is there that we mated with them. And again, we may have just kind of overrun them. There was, you know, because our numbers were increasing faster, we may have mated with them and just kind of swallowed them up genetically so that they disappeared. My personal theory is probably we did all three things. And in the end, when you get to around 25,000 years ago, they're just kind of gone.
Well, modern humans have certainly done all three in our history. So I can't say that I would be too surprised to find that that was the case.
Exactly. I mean, we've seen evidence of all of those behaviors, and humans, all humans, including Neanderthals, I'm sure, very complex. And, you know, so generally, though science likes to have a nice, simple answer, human history tells us that the answers are rarely simple.
We're almost at the end here, but given what's come before us, I think it's probably reasonable to assume there will be future human species, perhaps even a few different kinds after us.
I think so. I mean, there's no reason to believe that. I mean, I think that we tend to believe, because we're, again, kind of top of the food chain, we're a dominant species now. I mean, there's 7.2 billion of us. We're everywhere on the planet. And so we wake up in the morning, we tend to think we're in charge. But evolution keeps going, and we are even now contributing to our own evolution because of our rather sophisticated brains and our great ability to adapt and to be creative. We have begun to learn to change our own DNA. So we are actually evolution creating a new form of evolution. And we're rapidly changing the world. I mean, you know, all you have to do is pick up the newspaper every day, and technologies are remaking the planet and the way that we communicate with one another. So in the very last chapter, the epilogue of the book, I speculate on, you know, what that means for us. And I speculate that the next human will be, you know, one that I call cyber sapiens, where we begin to quite literally meld with our technology. You know, not necessarily the way the Borg did, you know, in Star Trek, you know, which is pretty unattractive, but we are remaking our DNA, and we are, you know, now messing with nanotechnology, which is essentially building machines at a molecular level, which is what DNA does. And whenever you begin to get down to that point, then you can begin to literally change the creatures that we are. And at some point, I think we will just morph into cyber sapien, assuming we don't wipe ourselves out in the meantime.
Yes, that is always, of course, a risk.
Yes, yes, it is.
Chip, thank you so much for being here.
That was my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
If you want to learn more about Chip Walter and his books, you can find his website at www.chipwalter.com, a link that will be available in our show notes. We'll be back after the break to talk with Dr. Brooke Crowley about the Anthropocene epoch, why it's important, and when it started.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're learning about the power and peril of the atom with two books about women who are instrumental in helping us unlock its secrets. We're joined by Huffington Post editor Shelley Emling to discuss her book, Marie Curie and Her Daughters, The Private Lives of Science's First Family. And we'll speak to author Denise Kiernan about her book, The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm here now with Dr. Brooke Crowley. Brooke is a quaternary paleoecologist and assistant professor in the Department of Geology and the Department of Anthropology at the University of Cincinnati. Thanks for being here, Brooke.
Good morning.
Okay, so I wanted to get you on today to talk about a sort of lesser known topic in, I guess it's anthropology, the Anthropocene. So can you tell us a little bit, what is the Anthropocene?
So the Anthropocene is a proposed time that represents the present. And how long it actually represents is debated. But it's the time that has been human influence. So we have had a measurable impact as a species, and that is on the globe's geosphere, ecosphere, and biosphere. This is a measurable impact. And many have proposed that we actually have a period of time that's official that marks this measurable impact.
So where does the term come from?
It's long been recognized that humans have an impact on Earth's systems. And the term the Anthropocene was actually first coined by an ecologist as kind of an analogy for the Holocene, which is the official current epoch. It was coined and popularized subsequently in around 2000 by an atmospheric scientist whose name is Paul Crutzen. And he used it as a way of symbolizing the past 150 to 200 years following the Industrial Revolution, when humans have had quite a major impact in terms of nutrient cycling, biodiversity loss, climate change, eutrophication of freshwater lakes, erosion and soil movement, just to name a few of the processes we've affected.
Okay, let's take a step back for just a second. Can you explain the divisions between geological epochs?
If we think about the Cenozoic, which is the last 65 million years, and we think about that as the age of mammals, where we've really radiated and come to be, including our own species. The Cenozoic is broken down into two main periods, which are the Tertiary period and the Quaternary period. The Quaternary spans the last 2.6 million years. And the Quaternary is broken down into the Pleistocene epoch and the Holocene epoch. Now, the Pleistocene is a time when climate fluctuated dramatically. So we had lots of glacial periods and interglacial periods. There's about at least 11, actually, that are currently recognized during the Pleistocene of these glacial interglacial periods. The last major glacial period ended around 15,000 years ago, and climate has been quite stable, relatively stable, over the last 11,500 years. And this sort of interglacial stable period is what we call the Holocene today. And we're currently living in the Holocene officially, although some have requested that we actually make an Anthropocene that follows the Holocene.
Why is the divisions between geological epochs important?
So we recognize the Holocene as a distinct unit, although it's just really the last interglacial period since the last glacial, because it's been really important for humans as a species. We have really come to be as we know ourselves during the Holocene. So we've domesticated animals, we've domesticated plants, we've settled down into large civilizations and big complex societies, permanent settlements. And prior to the Holocene, we really only lived in small groups. We were mostly hunter-gatherers. So this has been a monumental change in how we've lived. And then that's really one of the main reasons we consider the Holocene to be a distinct unit. Now, why would the Anthropocene potentially be something that we would want to consider as a distinct unit as well? Well, because humans have had a measurable impact. So where exactly does the Holocene end and the Anthropocene begin is what's more or less the main debate. Because there's not really just one single agreed upon criterion for what is the hallmark beginning of the Anthropocene, it's difficult to distinguish exactly when the Holocene ended and the Anthropocene began. And so by some definitions, the Holocene is basically analogous with the Anthropocene. And in others, the Anthropocene would only be the last 50 to 60 years.
Oh, so the Anthropocene, for some people, started, like, really recently.
Post-atomic weapon testing.
Wow, okay. Are there people who sort of tut-tut the idea of the Anthropocene in general, or is most of the debate pretty much around when did it start?
Well, in my opinion, it's really mostly about when did it start. So I'd say the vast majority of people on the planet are aware that we do have an impact. I mean, there's more than 7 billion people living on Earth today, so it'd be surprising to say, well, we don't have an impact. And I'd say the majority of people who argue that it doesn't exist or that we don't have an effect on the planet are people who might not be as well informed or potentially have a political agenda. But the vast majority of scientists and other academics, as well as a lot of, you know, just the general populace, would agree that the Anthropocene is something that exists. It's actually a term that's included now in the Encyclopedia Britannica. And there's a scientific journal that's devoted entirely to the Anthropocene. It's called The Anthropocene. And it's all about addressing the nature, scale, and extent of the influence that people have had on Earth. So it's something that's widely recognized, although it hasn't yet been officialized.
So can you tell me a little bit more about some of the competing theories and ideas, maybe specifically surrounding the start time?
There's several main sort of proposals about when the Anthropocene began. And the most widely cited one is the original Anthropocene argument, which is the one that was forwarded by Paul Crutzen, which is, says that the Anthropocene began with the Industrial Revolution, so last 150 to 200 years. And this revolution is something that's caused global climate change, biodiversity loss, pollution of land, sea, and air. We've had resource depredation and loss of land cover, for example, deforestation, on a scale that was currently, before this time, unprecedented. And again, that's the original definition and the one that's still most widely used, but there are others. So viewpoint two is one that we call the early Anthropocene hypothesis. And this is a viewpoint that says that the Anthropocene began about 8,000 years ago. And this is a time when the agricultural revolution had just gotten its kickoff. So we had lots of newly domesticated animals, domesticated crops, and humans were dispersed around the globe, and we had developed agricultural practices that actually did have a large-scale environmental impact. So, for example, having lots of cows increases methane production. Cows fart a lot, and so they actually produce a lot of methane. Same with rice. Rice produces a lot of methane, and so it's argued that by having lots more of these animals and plants on the landscape around the globe, we actually change the atmospheric concentration of some of the greenhouse gases. That would be the early Anthropocene hypothesis. The next viewpoint is called the Antiquity hypothesis, which argues that the Anthropocene began about 2,000 years ago. And this is a time when we had large human civilizations that were present on the majority of the main continents, including things like the Roman Empire, the Olmec Empire in Central America, the Mariotic Kingdom in Africa. And these large civilizations would have had widespread environmental impacts. They would have been large centers of populations. They would have had requirements for feeding and clothing and producing wealth for people there. And so that those would have had large impacts on all the continents, basically, other than Antarctica. And viewpoint four is this idea of a nuclear age Anthropocene. And this is one in which the Anthropocene sort of began after nuclear weapon testing in the 50s. So that would have had a global impact where we would have released elements into the atmosphere, and those are now in the sedimentological record that would have in quantities that were unprecedented. And so that's really like a golden spike, if you will, for a time that's very clearly measurable on a global scale. So all of these have their merits, and they're all very, I would say, good arguments. It's just a question of which is the best and which is the most easily measurable in the long term.
It's interesting. I'm sitting here thinking to myself, wow, that's a really big span of time to put a division. But we're not talking about, you know, a couple of thousand years here. We're talking about epochs. So I guess it's actually not too big of a, I guess, an error bar?
It's not. If you think about, I mean, other divisions in geologic time, they're constantly in fluctuation because we have better dating techniques for kind of pinpointing times in the past. We come up with a new way of distinguishing two different periods of time. And so just in my lifetime as a geologist, since I first started as a student, the division times have definitely changed. So I have to keep remembering new times. And those can change on the scale of like a million years. So, you know, 1 to 2,000 years is very, very small point of time. It just, on our life scale, it seems like a long period of time. Geologically speaking, it's the blip.
Just as a sidebar, do you think maybe that we might be able to, because it's so fresh and because we're looking at it so close to the division, that we might be able to mark this one with more precision than we have before?
I do. Part of that is because we have excellent written records. So if we were to use one of the more recent kind of viewpoints of when the Anthropocene began, such as the Industrial Revolution or the Nuclear Age, that is something that happened, for example, the Nuclear Age happened in some of our lifetimes, and we have excellent written records for the Industrial Revolution. So that's something we could, you know, pinpoint almost to the year. We could say, year James Watt invented the steam engine, that's the beginning of the Anthropocene. So that would be a very definitive date. If we were to use an earlier viewpoint of when the Anthropocene began, we'd have to rely on other types of records. But even those can be very well pinpointed. So, for example, there's ancient gases that are trapped in Antarctic ice cores. We can core those ices and measure the gas concentration in gases that are trapped in air bubbles in these Antarctic ice cores and date those very precisely and get an idea of how atmospheric gases have changed over the last 10,000 years. We can also look at soil records and pinpoint quite precisely when humans sort of started making big impacts on the pedosphere.
So is there a winning side here? Is there a theory that's pulling ahead?
That is something I'm not really sure. I would say, I guess, that the Industrial Revolution, since it's the most widely popularized, is, I guess, currently the winner. But in terms of something that really is globally instantaneous almost, would be the nuclear age. That's something that happened over a very short period of time, covered the entire globe. It'll be measurable in soils for basically ever in the future. So that might be, and I guess in my opinion, that's the best marker for the Anthropocene. Although it obviously has happened more recently than some of these other events that we think were human impacted.
That's really interesting that you say the marker for the atomic era will be in the soil forever. I didn't really think about that, but I suppose when we're talking epochs and impact, you know, in a million years from now, if there's still people around, that could actually be important that there's a record there.
Yes, and that's one that, I mean, it will be measurable. It won't, if we lose our written records, it will still be there.
Is the Anthropocene yet a formal epoch?
It is not yet formal, although there is definitely a push to make it formal. Now, in order for that to happen, there has to be, number one, unquestionable geologic evidence that it is a discrete entity. So there has to be unquestionable and robust data suggesting that humans have had an impact and that this is something that's quantifiable. And then there has to be some sort of agreement about the timing of its beginning. And so, again, I mentioned that I think that the nuclear age would be a good golden spike for the beginning of the Anthropocene. But this is something that there's a working group that's been put together that's actually working on formalizing a proposal to figure this out and to decide if indeed there will be a formal Anthropocene epoch.
So this is interesting as well. So who gets to decide? Is there a vote? Do all the anthropologists come to a big meeting? And like, is there a show of hands? How does something become formalized like an epoch?
There's actually an International Commission on Stratigraphy which is a subgroup of this larger unit called the International Union of Geosciences, and that's the official deciding unit. They are the ones who make the official time scale and make modifications to the official time scale. So there was originally a proposal to formalize the Anthropocene epoch in 2008. That commission thought that the proposal had merit, and so they put together a formal Anthropocene working group. That working group is composed of a number of geoscientists from other, diverse disciplines from all over the world, and they are gathering additional data to put together a new proposal, kind of with a formal decision about whether or not they approve of an Anthropocene epoch. And their target deadline for putting that together and submitting it to the commission is 2016. So that's coming up.
That's actually sooner than I anticipated, given we're talking about something that is sort of a massive time divisor. Interesting.
It's a big deal. People feel very strongly about it. And I mean, if it's formalized, then it's easier to institutionalize. We can teach it in classes. It's part of the official time scale. It's something that we will recognize, officially, which is instead of just saying it's this idea. And I think that will have some power. I personally would like to see it formalized.
Let's sort of zoom ahead speculatively. What kind of signs would we be looking for that the Anthropocene had come to an end?
Regardless of whether or not we formally recognize that there's an Anthropocene epoch, we're going to have continued impacts as a species on the planet. We're going to continue impacting atmosphere, hydrosphere, the geosphere, and the ecosphere. And what the future holds is really not that certain, because this is unprecedented. We're the first species to really affect this many different portions of the planet. So based on current trends, it would seem that we can anticipate, at least in the short term, more hot and unpredictable climate with less biodiversity. There's currently a lot of uncertainty, because we just don't know the future, as to how long the Anthropocene might last and what its end might look like. It could potentially be some sort of dramatic affair, where conditions change so rapidly and unprecedentedly that many species, possibly including us, go extinct at once. And that's sort of like what happened at the end of the Cretaceous when the dinosaurs went extinct. An alternative is that transitions are going to be slow. So modifications are going to be slow enough to the planet that there's going to be time for many plant and animal species to adapt to changing conditions. And that would be sort of a more transitional process, not an abrupt process. So there wouldn't be necessarily an abrupt ending to the Anthropocene in that case. Now, what's interesting about the Anthropocene, in my opinion, is that we're really the first species to have had a dramatic impact on the planet and be cognizant of it. We're not the first species to have had a dramatic impact on the planet, but we're the first ones to really be aware that we are having an impact and we have a role in shaping the Earth's future. And that's both amazing and a little bit horrifying. but I think what the key is to recognize that, to be aware that we have this influence and that we have a decision to make about how we're going to deal with that knowledge. We can be responsible or we could deny it. There's actually, so talking about the long term, there's an ecophysician whose name is Brian Furness, who came up with a term called the Sustainocene last year. And he proposed that if humans can go about figuring out a way to kind of achieve environmental integrity and ecological sustainability, so linking ecology, society, and economy, and thinking about this broader picture of Earth as our home for the long term and something that we need to work with, that we could potentially reach this thing called the Sustainocene, where we would be able to persist as a species potentially indefinitely if we're kind of good stewards of our planet. But that scenario is really, in order to achieve that, it's going to require some concerted, coordinated efforts from everyone on the planet. So they have to be supported by government policies, not just in one country, but around the world. And that obviously is probably going to be a big hurdle. But I think it's achievable. So that I think that this term is really exciting. I think it's great that someone's come out and said, it's not doomsday. We have a role here and we might be able to actually be able to shape the future of our planet in a beneficial way. It's not just all bad things. And so becoming kind of more environmentally conscious, for all of us, is really the first step towards reaching that reality of potentially making a sustainocene in the future.
It's fascinating that we may be the first species to consciously change the epoch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks so much for being here today, Brooke.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's it for us. You can visit us at scienceforthepeople.ca. And while you're there, click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, and over to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or if you're feeling good about it, give us a glowing review. Thanks for listening, and see you next week on Science for the People.
Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Schell.